For a lot of teachers around the country, today is their first day out of a job. Teacher contracts expired last night in many school districts, and state and city budget deficits have forced big cuts. In Milwaukee, 354 teachers are being laid off. In Chicago, 1,000, another 1,000 in Philadelphia. American education is so decentralized, it's hard to get a fix on what's happening nationally. But that's what Sean Cavanaugh tries to do. He covers state education policy for Education Week and joins us now. Hi.
Hi. Good to be here.
And first, do you have any sense of how many teachers could be laid off in the coming school year?
Well, there's no real way of knowing. And the estimates, as you mentioned, do vary considerably from state to state. The estimates of total layoffs for school employees were up around 60,000. But some of those have been pared back a bit as state revenues have picked up a bit and things have looked a bit more optimistic. But there will be layoffs and they will be significant in many, if not most, states.
And when you write about layoffs in one city or state or another, do you see recurring patterns of who's getting laid off, what kind of teachers or what point in their careers that they're at, or does it vary a great deal?
I think it varies a great deal. By and large, schools fight very hard, districts fight very hard to preserve the jobs of teachers in core subjects. Math, language arts, history, social studies, foreign languages, partly because in many cases those subjects are the ones being tested on a statewide test, and also because, quite frankly, those are the subjects that parents care most about. And so what you tend to see is cuts to the arts elective courses and so on. For a long time, teachers who had more seniority were most likely to be protected, although many states right now are moving away from that.
Short of layoffs, I assume school districts are also cutting a great deal. Typical ways of cutting spending?
A lot of cuts to extracurricular programs. We see cuts to professional development, the training that teachers get every summer. A lot of that is going away or at least being put on hold. Districts are avoiding making repairs to buildings, putting off maintenance. They're putting off the purchase of textbooks and technology. Any expense that can be conceivably pushed down the road without upsetting parents, school board members, others in the community are likely to be put on hold for quite some time.
Well, what effect does this latest wave of layoffs have on the relationship between school districts and teacher unions?
I think that this has been a very difficult time, a very strained time in terms of the relationship between state legislatures, state school boards, and teachers' unions. Teachers' unions are fighting to protect, quite frankly, the jobs of their members. State legislatures in a lot of states are trying to cut expenses in many of the ways that directly affect teachers. Benefits, cuts to health care, cuts to pensions, and changes in collective bargaining, which states argue will bring down the costs of districts.
It sounds like a tough job market for teachers right now.
Oh, no doubt. There's a lot of uncertainty about not only what's ahead for the fall, but realistically, state budgets aren't likely to rebound for another 2 to 4 years at least, and perhaps even longer.
Well, Sean Cavanaugh, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Sean Cavanaugh, who covers state education policy for Education Week. For a couple of years, states have been getting billions of extra dollars from Washington to help pay for health care for the poor. Today is the first day they'll have to do without it. Governors have long complained that Medicaid could swamp their budgets, but as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, some of the statistics they've been using may exaggerate the situation.
It's nothing new for governors to claim that Medicaid is wrecking their budgets. Here's Kentucky Democratic Governor Paul Patton back in 2002.
Quite simply, we have at present a crisis in Medicaid that is heading towards catastrophe.
And here's Tennessee Democratic Governor Phil Bredesen in 2005.
I simply do not have the money to keep the program going in its current form.
And not that much has changed. Scott Pattison is executive director of the National Association of State Budget Officers. In a recent appearance on C-SPAN, he explained what the loss of the additional Medicaid money from Washington might mean for strapped states in the coming year.
As a result, they have to go to other areas like K-12 spending to get the money to cover the health care costs.
In other words, states will have to take money away from education in order to spend more on health care. Last year's health law provides yet another Medicaid challenge for states. In most cases, it doesn't allow them to cut eligibility for Medicaid between now and 2014. And all the time, costs keep rising. Here's former Republican Kentucky Governor Ernie Fletcher testifying before the Senate Finance Committee just last week.
Medicaid has grown to consume about 22% of state budgets.
Now, that 22% number comes directly from the National Association of State Budget Officers. But some Medicaid advocates say those NASBO numbers actually overstate how much states spend on Medicaid.
What they're presenting is the total spending that the state does on all of its programs.
Ben Summers teaches health policy and economics at the Harvard School of Public Health.
And then it also includes the fact that revenues are coming from a variety of different sources, state funding, bonds, and then federal spending as well.
And when it comes to Medicaid, he says, those federal revenues account for more than half of the program's funding, even more in poorer states. So what happens to the picture of how much states spend on Medicaid if you subtract out the federal dollars?
Then that number drops to about 12%. And the implication here is that states are spending a lot of their money on Medicaid, but they're spending a lot less than they would be because the federal government is taking up more than half of the tab.
In other words, Medicaid stops being the biggest spending item in state budgets and falls to number 2 or 3 behind K-12 and higher education. Summers and other advocates for the program say there's a reason some people want to make Medicaid look as expensive as possible, and it has to do with politics.
So it becomes a potential punching bag for conservatives who are trying to argue that the federal government is overreaching, the Obama administration's health reform is unsustainable, and that the budget numbers just don't add up.
But NASBO official Stacey Mazur says the organization has perfectly reasonable, non-political reasons for organizing its numbers the way it does. Among them are that no matter where the money comes from, states are responsible for its being spent in a prudent way. But she says total spending also paints a more accurate picture of the Medicaid program over time.
And certainly the program is growing, similar to health care overall, at an annual rate of growth that exceeds state revenues or national economic growth, which really leads to budget pressures at all levels of government.
Which means that however you measure it, Medicaid is going to remain a problem going forward. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It takes a thief to catch a thief, and no one illustrates that adage better than Eugène-François Vidocq, a man who was immensely famous in 19th century France. Vidocq was the first director of France's Sûreté Nationale, their Scotland Yard, their FBI, if you will. He ran it from 1811 until 1832. Vidocq is considered the father of modern criminology, and he went on to found the first private detective agency. And for tracking down criminals and understanding their ways, Vidocq had the perfect background. He'd been a criminal. In fact, he had an extensive history of being incarcerated and then escaping from French prisons from the days of the French Revolution into the time of Napoleon Bonaparte. Vidocq is the subject of James Morton's new book, The First Detective, and James Morton joins us now from London. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And I'd like you to explain the role that Vidocq played, first at the intersection of criminal behavior and police work that led to his becoming a star detective later on, being a jailhouse snitch, being an informant.
Yes, what had happened was that the first 20 years of his life, he was in and out of trouble, both as a young boy, then as an adult. And he was a jewel thief, a womanizer, a braggart, a swordsman. And he was imprisoned a number of times. He was eventually sent to what were called the bagne, which were boats for really serious prisoners. And they were moored off French ports. They were thoroughly disagreeable places. The people were kept in irons, and on one occasion, Vidocq managed to escape. He returns to Paris, where he's betrayed by former colleagues, and he's either going back to the band for a very long time, or he's got to go back into a life of serious crime. And so he very cleverly, what the French call, he balances and goes to the police and says, look, I know everybody in criminal Paris. I can do anything you want and inform on them all. Don't send me back to the ban. They say, well, that's something. Let's see how your information works out. We're going to put you in prison and you can give us information from there and see how it works out. And if you do well, you stay out of the ban. If you don't do well, you go straight back. And he did well.
He did well. Is there any way that we can quantify how many people he managed to inform upon, or even for that matter, later as a detective, how many cases he actually made?
Well, he reckoned he'd had between 15,000 and 16,000 in his years of police service. So it was a substantial number.
Now, Vidocq contributed to his own legend by writing memoirs, which, as I understand from your book, were equally voluminous and unreliable.
Absolutely. He was a bit unfortunate with his ghostwriters, for a start, and there were certain rules which had to be observed if you were going to get a book, if not published, sold. So you had to have a certain amount of sex, you had to have a certain amount of adventure, really, as you do in any novel. And whether all the stories are absolutely accurate is another matter.
Was there a particular success that made Vidocq famous? I gather he was famous beyond the borders of France. He was famous in England and elsewhere on the continent. But was there a particular case he cracked that did it for him?
I don't know that there was one particular. I think it was just an accumulation. One of the ones he did, he was an undercover man as well as everything else. I mean, he was a great man for disguises, and he disguised himself from time to time as a Russian general, a beggar, which was easy enough, a duchess, which was a bit more difficult, and he infiltrated a gang of robbers and brought them all to the guillotine.
Yes, when you say that he once disguised himself as a duchess, as you remark, there are enough instances in his memoirs of his wearing women's clothing to make one wonder if it wasn't just a penchant for disguises. Did he enjoy wearing women's clothing?
No, unfortunately, he never wrote about whether he did or not. One suspects he was, what's the word nowadays, kinky?
He once was disguised as a nun and hid out in a farmhouse with the farmer's daughters in his nun's habit.
Well, this is the difficulty. In those days, books had to have a certain amount of sex in them to sell, and they certainly had to have a certain number of adventures. And rather like Casanova's memoirs, one's never quite sure how much is truth and how much was just done for the benefit of the reading public.
And this really is the original character on whom any number of fictional crime solvers, detective sleuths are based.
Absolutely. Vidocq is the prototype of Dupin, Edgar Allan Poe's detective. He features in Wilkie Collins. There was a very popular French detective called Lecoq by a man called Gaboriau. And you can see the resemblance of the name, even Vidocq Lecoq. Mm-hmm. Arsène Lupin, who was tremendously popular in France as a thief turned detective. And indeed, there's some suspicion that he contributes to Sherlock Holmes.
And in Les Misérables by Victor Hugo, he is the model both for Javert, the detective, but also Jean Valjean, the thief. He's both.
That's correct, yes. He knew Hugo quite well, and he always maintained that he'd written the Court of Miracles scene in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which he also claimed was the best bit of the book. As he would, since he was never one to hide his light under a bushel.
James Morton, the idea of the criminal crossing over to become the criminologist or the detective is interesting, but it requires a certain view of thieves and pimps and forgers that somewhere inside they're capable of behaving like you or me, or perhaps that somewhere inside you and I are capable of behaving like them. Were the French especially understanding of petty thieves and other crooks back in the 19th century, or did they just not know the full story of Vidocq?
I think they were attracted by this romantic figure because he was apparently quite good-looking, and he certainly was a good talker, good self-presenter. And I think they were attracted by this man who has quote, reformed, unquote, because we always like a criminal who reforms. And, of course, it, one way or another, he was cleaning up Paris crime. It may not have been a thoroughly desirable way, because there's no doubt he was quite capable of manufacturing cases against the criminals. Wouldn't be the first or the last policeman to do that. But, generally speaking, he was able to project an image in which he became enormously popular.
James Morton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Morton is the author of The First Detective, The Life and Revolutionary Times of Vidocq, Criminal, Spy, and Private Eye.
Here in Washington, deficit reduction talks have hit rough waters, with Democrats and Republicans at odds over taxes. At stake is whether the government will default on its debt if Congress doesn't vote to raise the federal debt limit. Well, our regular Friday political commentators, E.J. Dionne and David Brooks, join me now to talk about this and more. E.J. Dionne here in the studio. Welcome back, E.J.
Good to be here.
And David Brooks today joining us from Aspen Public Radio in Colorado, where he's been thinking deep thoughts all week. David, welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
President Obama held a news conference on Wednesday, and he chastised Republicans in Congress, told them to work harder to get a deal done, which prompted Republican Senator Pat Roberts to suggest that he take a Valium and calm down and come on down and talk to us. E.J. Dionne, a way out here, do you think?
Well, first of all, if this was Obama being over the top, then St. Francis of Assisi was a warmonger. I mean, this was not over the top. He was pointing out, in fact, if he really wanted to be tough, he would have said that it's absurd to be having this whole discussion. We should raise the debt ceiling and then argue about the budget. The Republicans have voted over and over again to raise the debt ceiling in the past, and suddenly they find purity. But I think he did make a very good point that you're going to hear a lot, which is, does it make any sense to default, to risk default, to defend tax breaks for corporate jets? David can count the number out on the tarmac there in Aspen. And for corporate jets, hedge fund managers and oil companies, you do that, you save those and cut Pell Grants for college kids. It's crazy. And so I think he's just beginning to ratchet up the rhetoric, but this was hardly over the top.
David Brooks, do you think the president has a successful shaming strategy here? Is this something that the public will get behind him with?
First, let me say there are a lot of corporate jets out here, but they're all owned by liberals. I don't think that what public matters. Uh-huh. What's happening in private is kind of interesting. The Republicans are holding extremely tough, not making even the slightest concession, and basically sort of threatening to throw the country into economic turmoil. And to be fair, the Democrats have moved a long way. They've caved on most of the issues. And the Republicans are still holding very tough. Now, the question is, are they holding tough because it has proved to be an extremely effective negotiating tactic, or are they holding tough because they actually believe it? And I don't think they know the answer to that, because there are a lot of Republicans who actually believe it and will not vote for a debt ceiling limit. The leaders clearly would like to make a compromise, but I'm not sure where the party is right now. So this is sort of a moment of discovery of what the party is. Either way, so far it's been a very effective negotiating technique.
And that's, if I could, that's why it was important for Obama finally to come out there and say, wait a minute, what are they doing? I talked to a very smart budget person this week who used the metaphor of the guns of August, appropriate enough since the deadline is at the beginning of August, that people on each side may miscalculate, and before we get into the soup, that we could accidentally go over the edge, which is why I think they better get pretty serious pretty quickly, which is why I think Obama himself said, let's get to work here. I think they're starting to worry that something that no one is calculating could happen.
If I could just say, I just think that's a real concern. I do think we're likely to have a moment of panic sometime this summer, and who knows whether it'll spiral out of control. Normally what happens is the parties of the incumbents say, let's get together. Mr. President, you'll probably be reelected if you do a deal, so we Republicans will hurt our Republican nominee. The Democrat says, you Republicans in the House will probably get reelected if we do a deal. I'm willing to hurt my congressional Democrats. Let's party of incumbents, let's us stick together. But that logic doesn't seem to be holding right now.
Let's move on and talk about the presidential campaign. There is a new Fox News poll which shows former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney running at 18% among Republican primary voters. In second place, actually, is somebody who's not running, at least not yet, and that's Rick Perry, the Texas governor, at 13%. David Brooks, what do you think about the chances that Rick Perry may actually jump into the race?
A lot of rumblings about Rick Perry these days among Republican fundraisers and insiders. A lot of people thinking he's likely to run. And he's certainly has to look at the money that's been raised, which has been pretty pathetic, the polling, and he pretty much has to see a pretty wide open opportunity for him to give it a serious run. So I would say Rick Perry's stock as a potential candidate is on the upswing.
You think so, EJ?
Well, I think what we're seeing in these Republican polls is Republicans are consistently saying, give me somebody else. Donald Trump's name got in the mix, and then he, of course, wasn't running. He soared up in the polls. Last couple of weeks, we've seen Rick Perry speculation. Now he's soaring in the polls. What struck me about this week is that the week was dominated by two people. One, Mitt Romney, who is just bashing away at the American economy. He's using an ad that the conservatives used against the British Labor Party back in the 70s and saying, Obama isn't working. The other person who got all the attention was Michelle Bachmann. And some of it was negative about all the government money she's gotten out of the government as an anti-government Republican, in terms of subsidies for agriculture and other subsidies for her husband's
family business. Right.
Yeah. But still, she's in the mix and the other guys have disappeared. So for at least this brief period, it's been Romney and Bachmann, which is why maybe people are looking at Rick Perry or almost anyone else. Hmm.
Let's end on this note. It was a good week in politics for this man.
Now, please form an orderly mob. My unpaid staff and I are ready to shake my little moneymaker.
That's comedian Stephen Colbert shaking his moneymaker after the Federal Election Commission yesterday voted to allow him to use Viacom money to form his Colbert Super PAC. David Brooks, aside from being great fodder to make this campaign year more fun, anything else here we should be talking about with Stephen Colbert?
Well, I hope he's the last candidate to shake his moneymaker in public. So far what's been striking to me is he's going to raise a lot of – he may outraise a lot of the Republican candidates. it's been pretty paltry, the amount of money so far. I suspect it'll kick in later.
Melissa, you should run. Why don't you go out there?
Well, thanks to you both. Have a great weekend and a great 4th of July.
Thank you.
You
Happy
too.
Happy 4th.
CJ Dion of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution and David Brooks of the New York Times.
This is Fresh Air.
Andrea Gale, do you read me? Do you read me? Come in. Come in, for God's sake, come in, Billy. These storms have collided. They are exploding.
That's Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio in the movie The Perfect Storm, playing our next guest, fishing boat captain Linda Greenlaw. She says her actual radio conversation with Captain Billy Tyne in 1991, believed to be the final contact made with the Andrea Gale before it disappeared in a storm, was less dramatic than the Hollywood version. But Greenlaw is a real commercial fisherman and the only female swordboat captain in the country. Sword fishing doesn't involve nets and trawling. During each fishing venture, Greenlaw and her crew will set thousands of individual hooks on a line and haul the massive creatures aboard one at a time. After years on the sea, Greenlaw left deepwater fishing for 10 years to set lobster traps and write books. Her first, The Hungry Ocean, became a bestseller, and she's written 5 more books of fiction and nonfiction. Last year, she returned to the deep water, and that voyage is the subject of her latest book. It's called Seaworthy, A Swordboat Captain Returns to the Sea, and it's now out in paperback. Linda Greenlaw spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last year.
Linda Greenlaw, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, in this book, you write, the position of skipper aboard a U.S. Grand Banks longline vessel is the absolute pinnacle of the commercial fishing world. And I'd like you to begin by just telling us what longline deep water sword fishing is, how it works.
Well, long lining is, as the name would suggest, the fishery itself is fishing a very long line. A typical set, which we do every night while we're at sea, is 40 miles. We lay out a 40-mile single strand of 1,000-pound test line onto which we attach about 1,000 baited hooks. And that attachment is called a leader. It's suspended basically fairly close to the surface. And we fish temperature breaks, for instance, east of the Grand Banks, which is where most of my experience is. We fish where the Gulf Stream, which is to the south, pushes up into the Labrador Current, which is cold water. These temperature breaks are where all the feed collects, and where there's prey, there should be a predator. That's where we fish.
Okay. And so every day you have this big spool on the deck, and you just roll out 40 miles of line, and you have floats every so often, right, which I guess allow you to retrieve these things later. And you leave these 40 miles and 1,000 baited leader hooks out for several hours and then reel them in the next day, right?
Yes, that's correct. And swordfish are nocturnal in that they feed at night. They come close to the surface to feed at night. So we set the line out in the evening, and at daylight we pick up the end of the 40-mile string and start hauling it back.
Okay. So now you got this crew of, you know, I guess 5 or 6 people on a boat that I guess in the case of the Seahawk, which you most recently were on, was like about, what, 63 feet?
Yeah, 63-foot boat, right. And I had a crew of 5 men.
Right. So you have 5 people that are baiting 1,000 hooks a day, reeling them out. And then when you reel them back in, explain the process there and what you do when you have a swordfish or some other kind of fish on it.
Okay, well, hauling the gear back, it's all hands on deck, including the captain, and that's my favorite part of the job is hauling the gear because it's just like Christmas. You know, can't wait to see what you're going to get. Tie into the end in the morning and start hauling it. The captain drives the boat along the line, kind of following these floats, as you mentioned. And when the line gets tight or you feel some strain on it, that means you have some weight on a hook. You back the boat down, stop the boat, hopefully, and see what you have. It comes to a point when the snap, or the thing that connects the hook to the main line, when that breaks the surface, it's hand-over-hand hauling, one man against one fish. And you hope it's a swordfish. Sometimes it's a shark, sometimes it's a tuna, sometimes it's mahi-mahi. But the target is swordfish. That's what we're all praying for.
And you can tell when it's a swordfish, right?
I can, yeah. I've been doing this a long time. I started swordfishing at the age of 19, so basically, I'm not fooled much when there's a little weight on the line. A swordfish acts totally different than a tuna or a shark.
Well, talk about that. How does a swordfish act?
A swordfish generally is pulling straight down, and when it gets close to the surface, it starts doing these circles. We call it a death circle, or we hope it's going to be a death circle and not a release circle. Tuna fish, often if you have the line in your hand, you feel a pump, pump, pump when it's pumping its tail, and you can really feel that if you have the line running through your hand. A shark generally does not dive down. It comes up to the surface, so the leader would be stretched out on the surface, and quite often you'd see a fin breaking the surface.
Now you got to get this thing aboard the boat, and I know from reading your book that there's a break in the gunwale, I mean the side of the ship, right? In effect, a door, right, where you can haul this. But it's still, you're talking about a 100-pound fish, right?
Yes, I mean, you're hoping it's a 100-pound fish. Last season, we had a 171-pound average. So these are big fish. And yes, there's a door cut in the side of the boat to make it a little easier to get the fish aboard. Basically, once the fish breaks the surface, you put gaffs in the fish to help pull it aboard. If it's a gigantic fish, we have a hydraulic lift that we can put a strap around the tail and pull the fish aboard that way.
Then what happens?
Once the fish is aboard the boat, the fish cleaner goes to work. It's very important for us to keep the quality of the fish really to high standards to get the money that we need to get for the fish to make a living. So the fish needs to be cleaned. That means, you know, the head comes off, the guts come out, salt water rinse, and it gets packed on salt water ice immediately. Really important to get the fish chilled really quickly and not leave the fish on deck.
So every day, assuming that the weather is decent and things are working, you are reeling out 40 miles of long line, baiting 1,000 hooks, pulling in those 1,000 hooks the next day, and then preparing to put them back out the next morning. It must be incredibly strenuous and sleep-depriving.
Sleep deprivation is a big part of the swordfish industry. We're lucky if we get 4 hours a night. You know, the days get long, you know, depending on weather, of course, is the biggest factor. If you're trying to haul the gear in bad weather, it just takes a little bit longer. Every fish, you know, that you stop to bring aboard, a little more difficult to get aboard in bad weather. Part offs are a huge factor in the length of a day.
It's where the line gets cut, right?
Yes, if you're hauling back the line and you have two or three or five part offs in a day, each time you have to chase the end, it's time consuming. A captain can make a bad set and catch a lot of sharks, very time consuming. So, yeah, the long days, you know, you're lucky if you get 4 hours sleep.
And how long does a trip last?
We generally keep our trips in sync with the lunar cycle. So a trip is, you know, 28 to 30 days, and that's the goal, is to keep on the lunar cycle, because the fishing is better because you're fishing these temperature breaks, and the moon obviously affects tide. I guess everyone's aware of that. But these temperature breaks are more defined from the first quarter through the full moon. So we try and do our steaming back and forth to the dock and our turnaround, or our time at the dock, unloading, resupplying during the new moon, or when you can't see any moon, and are fishing during when you can see a moon.
So you're typically at sea for about a month?
Yes, a typical trip is 30 days.
So when you're reeling in the line, these 1,000 baited leaders, how many swordfish will you typically get?
Oh, the success of a trip just varies so much. I've never been skunked. That means I've never been fishless at the end of a haulback. My biggest day was 107 fish. That's huge. Over 10,000 pounds of fish in one day. If you can average, 3,000 pounds a night, 30 fish, that's a good way to put a trip together. It's a grind. You're going to make 10 or 12 or 20 sets, whatever you need to do to get enough fish to go in with, without sort of overdoing the moon thing. You don't want to miss the next moon, so you can't stay out too long, and you don't want your fish to be too old. So, 3,000 pounds a night is a pretty good average.
So 1,000 hooks, 30 fish, and do it again the next day.
Exactly.
Right. So here you are. I mean, you're at very close quarters, working long hours with five or six other people. And you are a woman, which is rare in the business, right?
Yes, it is rare in the business.
I know from reading about you that you started sword fishing, I guess, when you were in college. And I'm just kind of curious, what was it like being a woman at sea? Was it different? Was it difficult?
I fell in love with fishing at the age of 19. I love what I do. And honestly, gender has not been an issue. I started on deck. I worked very hard, had an opportunity to run a boat, came up in the traditional way. I stayed on a boat long enough to become first mate. The owner of the boat bought a second boat. That was my opportunity to become captain. Worked very hard, eventually got good at it. I hire my own crew. A lot of questions are about, men working for a woman. I hire my own guys. Any man that doesn't want to go to sea with a woman hopefully won't ask me for a job. And that's not to say I've never had crew problems, because I have. But they haven't been as a result of my being a woman. Everyone has crew problems at one time or another.
I'd like you to tell one story that you relate in the book about a case where you saw a swordfish take on a shark.
Early in my sword fishing career, we fished on George's Banks, and part of the fishery that we were doing was harpooning, which is the most incredibly fun and exciting fishery. It's a sight fishery. My part of that was being the helmsman. I climb up the mast, I'm in the crow's nest, I'm driving the boat from up there and looking for fish swimming on the surface of the ocean. It's one fish. You're not seeing schools of fish. You're looking around for a single fish. Well, this particular day, I was up in the crow's nest. I saw fins. And I was like, wow, all right, cool. I put the boat in gear, and the captain's running out to the end of the stand or the pulpit from where you throw the harpoon. And as we approach the fins, which kept disappearing, I noticed that there were two sets of fins. One set of fins was a swordfish and a big one. And the second set of fins was a gigantic mako shark. Well, we watched a struggle between a mako shark and a swordfish. And the captain of the boat is wanting me to get the boat onto the mako shark so he can harpoon the shark, or the swordfish so we can harpoon the swordfish. We get up to the shark, harpoon it, and then look around for the fish. The fish is gone. And, of course, we're very disappointed. The fish is gone. A little while later, the fins pop up. Bang. Nope, we miss it. Fish is gone. So we missed a big fish. It was a huge fish. It was really a day saver. We really needed that fish. So we haul back the shark, get the shark on the deck. It's a big mako. And the guy cleaning the shark is just amazed at this little tiny baby swordfish that was in the shark's belly. And suddenly I felt okay about this big swordfish getting away, because I had a feeling that the swordfish and the shark were fighting or, you know, struggling together. The swordfish was upset. I mean, the shark ate the swordfish's baby. So I felt good about killing the shark, and I felt kind of okay about the swordfish getting away.
Linda Greenlaw, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Linda Greenlaw speaking with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last year. Her book, Seaworthy, A Swordboat Captain Returns to the Sea, is now out in paperback. And she's also written a cookbook with her mother, Martha Greenlaw. It's called The Maine Summers Cookbook.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll hear about a major music and cultural celebration that's bringing some 400,000 people to New Orleans this weekend. It's the Essence Music Festival, and we'll hear about it in just a few minutes. But first to Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. And today we're going to hear about the first African-American woman ordained a rabbi. Alyssa Stanton made headlines when she was ordained after completing her studies at Cincinnati's Hebrew Union College. Then she took over the only synagogue in Greenville, North Carolina. That was in 2009. But the synagogue, Beit Shalom, has announced that Rabbi Stanton's contract will not be renewed when it expires this month. Rabbi Stanton joins us now to tell us more about her journey. She's with us from Greenville, North Carolina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about how you first arrived at this journey, for those who haven't followed your story. That what inspired you to, well, first to convert to Judaism? As I understand it, you were raised Pentecostal, and then first to convert to Judaism, and then to become a rabbi.
The journey started when I was a little girl. At nine, I started my search. And why that is so vivid is one night the phone rang, and my sister answered the phone. My sister, Val, is 7 years older than I. And she handed the phone to my mother, and I was upset because the phone was for me. I had called a priest to find out more about Catholicism and to make an appointment with him at 9 years old. And so a man calls a nine-year-old girl at 9 o'clock at night would be concern for any parent. So that's when my journey began officially, and that I can recall.
What made you want to become a rabbi?
It was just a calling, I believe. I had moved to Denver. I was a psychotherapist. And I had a traditional conversion in my early 20s. And I was taught that Reformed Jews were not real Jews. I kept hearing about the synagogue in Denver that were doing some exciting things. And the first time I went and heads turned, it wasn't because of the stares of what are you doing here. It was, oh, another new face. And so I went back. But when I was in the midst of my conversion and I learned about the role of a cantor, which is leading people to prayer through music, I thought that would be my nirvana. I mean, to be able to sing and pray and praise God and get paid for it. And so I said, okay, God, open the door and point the way. And I went to my rabbi. God is blessing, and the rest is history, so to speak.
What will you be, I'm not sure if you even embrace this concept, but what do you think you will be proudest of as your in your tenure at Beit Shalom?
Proudest of? There's a quote, I don't know who it's by, but it says something in essence of, sometimes it's worth the risk of losing everything for the sake of integrity. And I found that to be true, that I haven't given up. And at the same time, I haven't compromised who the rabbi that God has ordained me to be.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and we're speaking with Rabbi Alyssa Stanton. She is the first African-American woman to be ordained as a rabbi, and she's serving out her two-year contract at Greenville, North Carolina's only synagogue, and we're speaking to her from there. What do you think is next for you?
I had started a nonprofit that is called EPO, which is Hope Backwards. And it's a nonprofit that where commonalities are embraced and differences are accepted. I'm also finishing up a book. The tentative title is Lessons to the Rabbi. I do a monologue, Layers of Healing, Layers of Hope, about my journey. I've had the opportunity to do it all around the United States. And teaching seminars and lectures. I will continue doing those things. And I will continue to be on my outreach to people of all faiths and clergy of all faiths, because I believe that together we can invoke change in this world.
Now, obviously, you know, you're still serving and there are still relationships that you want to be respectful of. But I am curious whether there are aspects of your identity, either being African-American or female, that posed a greater challenge than you had thought that it would, or perhaps were more of an advantage than you perhaps thought it would be.
I think depending on the day, you know, one can look at the cup as half full or half empty. I think both of those, realistically, you know, in dealing with the elephant in the room, I'm a woman, I'm a single parent, I'm an African-American rabbi who happens to be female. Each of those in itself presents its own uniqueness and its own challenges. But when you combine them together, it's a lot for some people. And typically, even the sign for rabbi in American Sign Language, ASL, is a sign for a beard. And so traditionally, there hasn't been a place for women until recent years. And then I come along, it provides challenges for some and opportunities of others. Recently, I had a congregant who was concerned about me living. And the congregant has children and said, "You're the only rabbi that my children know. You're the only rabbi that my children want." And so in their eyes, an African-American woman is what a rabbi is. To others who are older, who are used to seeing an Anglo male, that is their concept of what a rabbi is and should be. Are either one of them greater than the other? Absolutely not. But it just is. So I'm one to deal with the issues head on. Other people have not honed those skills as well. And so we just deal with it to the best of our ability. So I look forward to a great future, serving humanity, my people, and our God.
Alyssa Stanton is the first African-American woman to be ordained and to work as a rabbi. And she was kind enough to join us from her home office in Greenville. Rabbi Stanton, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Shalom.
Shalom.